It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, our analysts, Megan Goldberg is with us, assistant professor of American politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Megan, welcome to the program.
Great, Ben. Great to be back.
Great to have you back. Evan Renfro, great to have Evan back, assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Thank you for joining us, Evan.
Howdy, Ben. Good to be with you.
Great. And we always invite our listeners on our Politics Wednesdays to join our conversation. You should have this on your refrigerator or wherever you keep important phone numbers, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. A bit of news here within the last few minutes. Natalie Krebs, our health reporter, covering the governor's actions here. I'll just announce this. Effective Friday, restrictions on all businesses will be lifted in all of Iowa's counties. Businesses will be issued guidance from the Iowa Department of Public Health. That announcement from the governor within the last few minutes, and we'll be talking tomorrow in more detail about that here on River to River. Later in the program, we'll want to discuss with Megan and Evan the split in Congress over more financial relief for states. Also some polling, interesting polling. I want their views on this, showing disaffected Republicans and independents. They were key in the 2016 election. Now it seems they strongly prefer Biden. We'll talk about that. More developments in the case of the president's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn. But first of all, let's get back to the Senate testimony yesterday. Your comments on remarks during a high profile. This was partially virtual hearing before the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. This was the first chance lawmakers had to publicly question the government's top health officials in Congress since Donald Trump declared a national emergency 2 months ago, and the first questions for these experts without President Trump standing nearby. Now, health officials painted a grim picture of the months ahead, warning a Senate panel that the coronavirus pandemic was far from contained. Let's hear some audio from yesterday's testimony. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, noted that while some parts of the country are seeing decreased cases of COVID-19, other areas are seeing concerning spikes in cases and hospitalizations.
Right now, it depends on what you mean by containment. If you think that we have it completely under control, we don't. I mean, if you look at the dynamics of the outbreak, we are seeing a diminution of hospitalizations and infections in some places, such as in New York City, which has plateaued and starting to come down, New Orleans, but in other parts of the country, we are seeing spikes. So I think we're going in the right direction, but the right direction does not mean we have by any means total control of this outbreak.
Here's another exchange during that testimony yesterday. Interesting, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul challenged Dr. Fauci, expressing concerns over guidance for state reopening efforts. Here's how Dr. Fauci responded.
I think the one size fits all, that we're going to have a national strategy and nobody's going to go to school, is kind of ridiculous. We really ought to be doing it school district by school district. So I think we ought to have a little bit of humility in our belief that we know what's best for the economy. And as much as I respect you, Dr. Fauci, I don't think you're the end all. I don't think you're the one person that gets to make a decision. We can listen to your advice, but there are people on the other side saying there's not going to be a surge.
I have never made myself out to be the end-all and only voice in this. I'm a scientist, a physician, and a public health official. I give advice according to the best scientific evidence. There are a number of other people who come into that and give advice that are more related to the things that you spoke about the need to get the country back open again and economically. I don't give advice about economic things. I don't give advice about anything other than public health. So I wanted to respond to that. The second thing is that you use the word we should be humble about what we don't know. And I think that falls under the fact that we don't know everything about this virus. And we really better be very careful, particularly when it comes to children. Because the more and more we learn, we're seeing things about what this virus can do that we didn't see from the studies in China or in Europe.
Dr. Fauci went on to say, I am very careful and hopefully humble in knowing that I don't know everything about this disease. And that's why I'm very reserved in making broad predictions. The words of Dr. Fauci there. Let's start with you, Megan. What do you make of this testimony? I don't know how much you followed of it yesterday. Given this very different picture than the one painted by the president. This is a president, we remind ourselves, who has cheered for a swift reopening, nothing wrong in that, but who has also encouraged protesters demanding an end to the quarantine. And this testimony comes just a day after Donald Trump declared that, in his words, we have met the moment and we have prevailed. Megan, what do you think?
So I think we talked about this about a month ago when I was on the show about these press conferences, which is where we've gotten a lot of information from these experts before. Those press conferences were really designed by Trump and his team to take place of almost like campaign events that he would normally be having. You know, the purpose of those press events was not necessarily for us to get this sort of information, but for Trump to rally support. And so I think that it was really interesting to get a chance to hear from these health experts on a different stage. But I also think that, it was very public, obviously. And so this was also a chance for Republican and Democratic senators to sort of do position taking as well. Rand Paul is showing his constituents. He wasn't asking those questions because he necessarily wanted an answer and advice from Dr. Fauci, but to sort of stake out a position that was very public for his constituents, that he is prioritizing getting things open and things like that. So I think that it was sort of fascinating to watch sort of the different purposes, the experts testifying. Their goals, I think, were to sort of get this information out, but they're still in a political context. Just a slightly different political context.
Evan, what do you think of this? The first time these national health experts have been questioned without Donald Trump standing nearby and without that sort of mantle of the coronavirus task force at the White House.
Right. Yeah. So a couple things here. One is that clip sort of embodies a microcosm of a larger phenomenon that's occurring. But to break down or unpack a little bit about what the good doctor was testifying to, we have it under control in certain areas, and you're seeing it rise in other areas. But a component of that, of course, for data collection is testing. And the president himself has said, we shouldn't be doing testing because it just makes us look bad. So as long as you don't count or test people, those numbers are going to go down everywhere. So you can always say, you have it under control from the president's perspective, at least. This sort of shows the bifurcation in politics between public health experts and expertise versus those more inclined towards a political or economic viewpoint. This is a turning out to be a culture war here over face masks and in a time of pandemic. So this is where we're at.
Mm-hmm. Evan, what do you think will prevail when it comes to public policy, the actual public policy enacted? We're seeing it played out in 50 different sort of experiments, you could say, in our states. Science or politics, a mix? How do you see those going together? I just announced some breaking news here from our governor as well, which is, I guess, best described as a mix, huh?
Yeah, I tell you, it'd be great to be a first-year graduate student right now because you'll have plenty of material for dissertation on this when the dust has settled to see in those 50 laboratory experiments what works, what doesn't. The president, say what you will, is very, very skilled politically. And, I'm going to get hurt here in my fumbling of this pandemic, so let's make it into a culture war rather than one about public health. So, again, we're yet to see what comes from all of this.
To finish up on that testimony, Megan, any other things that occurred to you in watching it to mention?
I do think that Rand made an interesting point about having a national response versus a state-level response. And Dr. Fauci's response was pretty appropriate, that it is true that, we're starting to see nationally some numbers decline, but a lot of that's going to be driven by New York. I think Rand has a point that you could potentially, there's a benefit in having a flexible response instead of sort of a blanket national guideline. But I think Dr. Fauci is hoping that giving states more power, you also have states that are being influenced by the science and not just sort of by this culture war. But I think Evan is absolutely right that we're seeing unfold.
Mm-hmm. Evan, especially with your international expertise, do you see any other countries like the United States at all alike? We talk about 50 laboratories, 50 experiments going on. When we look at Germany, we look at England, the UK, we look at South Korea. They are all under a system that where it's very centralized. Are there any other sort of decentralized experiments going on as we have here?
You do have places all over the world suffering from this, and some you won't ever hear about. I get this question, what's going on in the Middle East in general? And it's very difficult to answer because they simply don't have the apparatus set up to document or report these sorts of things. And then you have a sort of an outlier country in Western Europe, Sweden, that really mishandled this and, is clearly paying the consequences for that. So there's a spectrum of success stories versus catastrophic stories versus many, many countries that we don't know anything about what's happening in so far as this novel virus.
Mm-hmm. Testimony yesterday, and I haven't fact-checked this, but it comes from Senator Tim Kaine, the Democrat of Virginia. This testimony came yesterday when the U.S. had surpassed 81,000 fatalities. Senator Kaine noted in his testimony that was 45 times the rate of South Korea. Let's talk a little bit about the economic side here, if we could. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi unveiling the Democrats' sort of opening offer in the next round of coronavirus stimulus, a $3 trillion bill that includes $1,200 in direct payments to Americans, extended unemployment benefits, mortgage relief. Republicans saying they will counter with a bill to shield businesses from virus-related lawsuits. Megan, how would you characterize how Republicans and Democrats in Congress stand on more financial relief? Are you seeing a breakdown in what each major party wants here?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And, we saw this in the previous relief bill, that this is a chance for both parties to sort of pursue some goals they've had for a long time, and to do so under, sort of the urgent need to pass legislation during this. But I think that one issue that's going to come up as this sort of moves forward is, as states are reopening, who will actually qualify for any of these payments? When businesses are open, what sort of relief can they qualify for? That's sort of an issue at a state level. I know, I've seen just anecdotally accounts from business owners, especially people who, hairstylists and things like that, who have to be in direct contact with their customers, that, once they're allowed to be open, they no longer qualify for unemployment. So they have no choice, really, but to go back to work. So I think that's going to be a conflict we'll start to see play out a little. And I think it'll be sort of interesting, given where the parties normally break down over assistance. In previous bills here, it's been people who are forced out of work. And now that's not the case. And we see that as sort of a conflict emerging in Iowa as things start to reopen. What about these people who are too scared to go back to work? Are they no longer eligible for any of this assistance?
Mm-hmm. How do you see future relief packages from Congress fitting in, Evan?
Well, I agree with Megan. I would just add to that, Mitch McConnell has said that his red line, the Republicans and Democrats agree on, a lot of stuff here, on the need to get stimulus money out there. It's some sticking points here, one of which is related, and it's what Mitch McConnell calls his red line, which is, unless there's some statute in this legislation that protects business owners from being sued by employees returning to work, then it's never going to clear the Senate. So that's one of the key sticking points here that you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, what about this partisan divide? We have Senator Rick Scott of Florida, some other Republicans arguing, really saying, why should Congress help struggling states and cities when the bulk of the aid would go to Democratic strongholds? that he said had a history. This is Rick Scott of Florida, had a history of fiscal mismanagement. He's pointing to New York, Illinois, California. Also, President Trump has been echoing this sort of argumentation. He's gone after the Democratic governors, accusing them of mismanaging their finances. He's charged that the party's members in Congress, in his words, want to help bailouts. And you know, bailouts are very tough, said the president, and they happen to be Democrat states. Megan, so there is a highly partisan, no surprise there, highly partisan profile here, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is true that probably blue states are struggling the most right now. But really, in a lot of ways, that's a geography problem. You know, because this was coming, pandemic was coming across the ocean, it's going to hit coastal states first. And it so happens that most coastal states are blue states. So I think it's a little short-sighted because, you know, I think eventually this is going to come to the middle of the country, you know, in a stronger and more severe way that it is now, and that red states are eventually possibly going to need that too. But I think that this is sort of it's an interesting dynamic because usually the reverse is true, that blue states tend to pay more sort of like into the federal government and get less back from the federal government, and that red states often get a much higher amount in block grants and other financial right. assistance from the federal government. And so I think that, you know, were I a senator from a red state or a member of Congress from a red state, I'd be a little nervous about retribution, given that my state usually relies on those federal dollars.
Right, and we heard that a few weeks ago, didn't we, in Kentucky, actually Mitch McConnell talking, going along this line of argumentation. Andrew Cuomo, governor of New York, Evan, was right there ready to say exactly what Megan said, right?
Well, that's exactly right. You know, a lot of people complain about handouts unless it's their own handouts. I mean, this reminds me, you know, whenever a hurricane comes, and Chris Christie was the governor of Jersey, and President Obama at the time made sure that New Jersey got aid from the federal government. All of a sudden, that was a great idea. Same thing in Texas with its political entities, and when a natural disaster hits, all of a sudden we need federal government support. So this is, you know, sort of the human nature of it's a helping hand to me, but it's a handout for everybody else type deal.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's move on a little bit. We want to talk about far too much to talk about in the hour. We'll get to as much as possible, inviting our listeners to join us. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. 4 or 5 minutes before we have to take a break, but let's at least start off with this. The Supreme Court yesterday hearing arguments. This was held by telephone. It was broadcast live, so unprecedented for the U.S. Supreme Court. This is over the subpoenas of Donald Trump's financial records. The justices and lawyers during this session grappled with, well, over 250 years of American history, the investigations of presidents. They talked about questions about the future separation of powers, the cases tackled here, whether this president can stop the democratically controlled House of Representatives from getting his tax and banking records from an accounting firm along with two banks that he used, and whether the president can halt a grand jury investigation, this in Manhattan, that also seeks his tax records. Now, the arguments were heard yesterday. The rulings aren't expected until summer. Let's hear a little bit of that testimony. This is the attorney to the president, Jay Sekulow, asking the U.S. Supreme Court for, quote, temporary presidential immunity. This would mean that the president couldn't be investigated or prosecuted while in office. This includes restrictions on subpoenas and testimonies. Justice Sonia Sotomayor raised concerns. Let's listen.
Counsel, it seems that you're asking for a broadness of immunity that Justice Thomas pointed out is nowhere in the Constitution. I'm not sure why he's entitled to more immunity for private acts than he should be for public acts.
Okay, here's the president's attorney, Jay Sekulow's response to Justice Sotomayor, and more from the justice herself.
Well, he's the president of the United States. He is a branch of the federal government.
We only give judicial officers and congressional officers immunity for acts within their official capacity. If they don't, if judges sexually harass someone, we've said that's not within judicial functions, they can be sued. If congressmen do the same thing, they can be sued.
We're asking for temporary presidential immunity. There are hundreds of members of the United States Congress and 100 members of the United States Senate. There is one president.
Okay, some of the testimony yesterday, the arguments before the Supreme Court yesterday. We have a couple minutes, less than a couple minutes before we have to take a break. Megan, start us off. Help us understand what the High Court is grappling with here.
I think this is a fascinating case. There's a lot of different, in these sort of different smaller cases that are happening, there's a lot of different questions. And the president's lawyers have sort of, it seems like, just instead of sort of grappling with these individual questions of like state versus national supremacy and congressional investigations, are just sort of asking for this huge blanket immunity, which in a way is a much simpler question, which I think might hurt them in the long run if they're really sort of like reaching for the type of immunity that is really absolute.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Evan, quickly, so the Supreme Court could rule that a sitting president is immune from any scrutiny, either from Congress or from Manhattan courts, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I think the president's attorneys have a little bit of an uphill argument to make because there seems to be a couple of precedents for this. For instance, Nixon in 1974, Supreme Court ruled unanimously that he had to comply with the federal grand jury subpoena for his tapes, which ultimately led to his impeachment. Then again in 1997, another unanimous decision by the Supreme Court said that Clinton had to testify. To give a blanket immunity like this would definitely be a unique reading of law.
Okay, we have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, our two political analysts, or professors of political science helping us pull apart some of the politics of the recent days. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We'll finish up talking about that. I want to ask our guests, why do we limit, make the president immune, at least from some prosecution, while in office, and how this case might turn out before the Supreme Court. Then we'll talk about some more developments in the case of the president's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn. An interesting twist there yesterday in the news. We'll talk about it. It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. Glad you're on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, as our days get warmer and social distancing restrictions decrease across the state, many Iowans are flocking to state, city, and county parks to enjoy the sun, get out of the house. Well, what are parks and government bodies doing to ensure the safest park experience for those of us who visit? How risky is it to visit a state park? We'll look at these questions tomorrow on the show. Today, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River with our guests, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa, both in their respective departments of political science. We want to finish up talking about what the Supreme Court was hearing yesterday, arguments over the subpoenas of Donald Trump's financial records. Donald Trump, his lawyers, stop the democratically controlled House of Representatives from getting his tax and banking records from an accounting firm, along with two banks that he used, at Deutsche Bank, for instance? Whether the president can halt a grand jury investigation in Manhattan that seeks his tax records? We've been talking about that. Justin is on the line. He's been listening. Justin, welcome to the program. What did you want to pitch into that discussion?
I just had a quick question, or I guess a couple of questions here. Are all of these potential cases against Trump just backpiling right now and going to be acted against when he leaves office and loses that protected status as a sitting president? So, like, basically, when he leaves office, is he going to be presented with a slew of lawsuits that are currently not able to be acted upon?
Great question, Justin. Megan, what can we tell Justin there?
So I think that absolutely, the president is protected to some degree already from investigations. Particular types of indictments. But once he leaves office, obviously that is no longer the case. But I think that particularly the case in New York is arguing that they should be allowed to move forward with this investigation even while he's in office, because otherwise their case will be effectively destroyed because evidence gets lost. People forget. It's basically like, don't let us lose our train of thought where we are right now. So this is sort of an argument. Like, I think that the case in New York, if there were to be criminal charges, would be brought after Trump leaves office. But I think they're arguing for these subpoenas because they want to be able to sort of keep the momentum up with their case and are worried that by losing it, they would lose the case entirely.
Mm-hmm. Evan, I wonder if you could put this Supreme Court case or these cases in the context of, the idea that our founders had in terms of the balance of power among the three branches of government. Here we have Congress, the legislative branch, and then the top of the executive branch, the president, going head to head. And this is a test of power that will have, repercussions for decades and many future presidents, possibly.
Oh, for sure. Again, it would be overturning a couple of cases of precedents here, but anything's possible to do. I suppose it would be a rereading of the Constitution insofar as, yes, the president, most legal scholars would agree, has a limited immunity while being held in office. Otherwise, presidents would be, serve subpoenas every day by every Tom, Dick, and Harriet, district attorney around the country that wanted to annoy or harass them. So you have some limited immunity. Nobody argues against that. However, this idea where you can ignore the legislative branch, particularly House subpoenas, would be a radical reordering of the balance of powers.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about a strange twist in the case of the president's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn. If I'm remembering correctly, the shortest term for a national security advisor in U.S. history, I think it was something like 30 days, wasn't it, Evan?
Yeah, he has the record for that.
Okay. More developments yesterday. A judge put on hold the Justice Department's move to drop charges against Michael Flynn. The U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan said he expects individuals and organizations will seek to intervene in this politically charged case. This order comes after the government took the unusual step last week, we remember, of reversing its stance on upholding Flynn's guilty plea. Flynn, convicted of lying to FBI investigators about his contacts with the Russian ambassador, he pleaded guilty twice, Megan, to this. So this latest development, make a little bit of sense of it for us, if you can.
I think that this is actually really interesting in light of the comment some of Trump's lawyers made. So they made a comment about the president is one person. Just Trump is like an entire branch of government. And that's not really true. The executive branch is huge. And Trump has been trying, especially we see this with the Department of Justice, trying to exert his control over all of these different facets of the executive branch. And this is a case where I think, we sort of see this checks and balances in action, that even though the president is trying to exert control over some executive agencies, that the courts are going to push back against some of this. So I think that, what we see is that he might try to exert control over within the executive branch, but he can't necessarily extend that. We know we've seen him not be able to extend that control over right now the House. And so this is going to be an interesting test. This and the Supreme Court case, how much control, how much influence does he have over the courts?
Mm-hmm. To finish up here, Evan, is the outcome clear here, or do we wait for another twist and turn in this Michael Flynn case?
Yeah, I think we have to wait, because what Flynn and his legal team and, by extension, Attorney General Barr have done is really tick off the federal judge involved, because Flynn pleaded guilty twice, including in the presence, you know, to the face of the judge. And so now the federal judge has said, rather than making a ruling, he's going to bring in potential friends of the court and others to argue why the Justice Department maybe should not actually drop these charges. So some of this is still up in the air, but it's not a good general rule of thumb. It's not a good idea to tick off federal judges.
Mm-hmm. Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, if you've just joined us, Politics Wednesday. Let's talk about this. An interesting article I emailed to you for discussion. Politico, under the headline, MAGA Speech Clashes with Coronavirus Misinformation Crackdown. It's an article about how some conservative pundits consider political speech is violating social media rules to prevent potentially dangerous coronavirus conspiracy theories from spreading. And just to sum it up, here's the first paragraph. In recent weeks, everyone from conservative commentator Candace Owens to popular vloggers Diamond and Silk to Trump booster and former Milwaukee Sheriff David Clark Jr. to Fox News personalities have had tweets deleted for running afoul of Twitter's coronavirus misinformation policy. Lockdown protesters frequently post fears that social media companies like Facebook will delete the group pages on which they organize. Then over the weekend, this is continuing the Politico article, then over the weekend, the far-right fringe raised hell when Facebook and YouTube pulled down the film Plandemic, a pseudoscientific documentary that pushes baseless theories about the coronavirus, including that the flu vaccine contains the disease and that wearing masks could cause people to infect themselves. MAGA World has loudly pointed to the incidents as concrete evidence of the vague conspiracy theories they have long pushed about social media giants trying to silence conservative voices. End of that article quote. A bit lengthy, but I wanted to get the point across. Evan, thoughts on whether potentially dangerous coronavirus conspiracy theories should be protected political speech? Where do we draw the line?
Well, I think at the Constitution. I mean, I tell my students this. There's always a fundamental and common misconception about what free speech is, according to the Constitution. So if you're working within the confines of a private enterprise, whether that be a Pizza Hut or Facebook or whatever, that private enterprise gets to decide what you can say is appropriate or inappropriate and then ask you to leave their facilities, whether that's a physical structure or a virtual one.
Mm-hmm.
What free speech in the Constitution protects, however, it's we don't go and get arrested by a government agency for saying these things. So Twitter, Facebook, YouTube can do they can play by their own rules. The government is not somehow arresting you. So that's what free speech does. It gives you that protection. Okay, but see, this is the key. This is the key fundamental issue at the bottom of this entire argument here.
Mm-hmm. Megan, your thoughts and thoughts on the social media largest platforms, Twitter, Facebook, increasing regulation of content. Your thoughts.
Yeah, I 100% agree with Evan that, you know, we've gotten so used to it, especially right now when our world is a virtual world. You know, we think of these social media platforms as the public sphere, but they're not. They are private enterprises. And so just like Evan said, you know, if you could think of it almost like these, especially these pundits who that's sort of their main platform, you can think of it, it's almost like an office they're renting. Usually they're renting it free of charge, right? They don't have to pay to be on Twitter. And so there's no, you know, it's, you might call it censorship by Twitter, but that's not the same as protected speech or violation of protected speech. But I think the sort of question at hand here is, at what point is, if you're spreading misinformation about this, you know, the sort of famous line about protected speech is you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. So at what point is saying, you know, don't wear a mask, that the flu vaccine contains strains of this virus, you know, all of these sort of myths that are being propagated, these conspiracy theories, at what point is that akin to shouting fire in a crowded building? Is it when you're, and we saw there's a study out that shows or that suggests that people who watched particular shows on Fox News were more in danger of being infected. And so, you know, if your actions, if your speech is directly leading to more infections and more deaths, is that a yelling fire analogy? So I think that's sort of the interesting question that maybe needs to be addressed here.
Mm-hmm. Don't we often, though, take care of that in our legal system by if you cause harm in that way, then you can be held accountable with a lawsuit, Evan, right? I mean, injuries resulting from yelling fire in a theater when there is no fire, for instance.
Sure, you could be held criminally responsible or civilly responsible. You know, if you yell fire and I break my leg scrambling out, well, I'm gonna sue you, and you're also going to be liable for criminal charges.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but that, well, again, is a whole different, yeah, that's a different reading or a different category or principle of law that, you know, than this plandemic stuff, you know.
Yeah.
No, you know, so in other words, we're not, the United States government is not going out and arresting people for making lies up about the coronavirus and putting them on YouTube. It's just YouTube is not allowing them to propagate the lies that could potentially be dangerous due to their own private policy.
Right, and these are private enterprises. Much as we see them in every facet of our lives, Twitter and Facebook, they are just private companies, very large private companies that have become enmeshed in our culture. I want to talk before we end our conversation here in less than 10 minutes, your views, Evan and Megan, on polling of a very specific group of voters that caught my eyes, voters who in this election coming up and the 2016 election don't like either major party candidate. In 2016, this was a large group of voters who disliked both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And in 2016, that group broke sharply for Donald Trump. Now, according to some polling conducted by Republicans and Democrats, the opposite is happening. Public polling, private surveys. Well, let's take this one from last week. Monmouth University poll showing disaffected Republicans and independents strongly preferring Biden. The former vice president leads Donald Trump by more than 40 percentage points among that group. This accounts for nearly quarter of the registered voters. I don't know how much you looked at this polling, but Megan, how significant is that? How do you interpret it?
Yes, I think it's very interesting. I think it suggests a lot about Trump's performance, perhaps recently, because you know this group that if they're not as influenced by party, we have to sort of look at what are they influenced by. And so one of the other major influences on vote choice, you know, might be your evaluation of the candidate, of the incumbent party. And so this is maybe just sort of like frustration with incumbents. But I think that in terms of how significant it will be in November, I think there's sort of two sort of grains of salt here. One is that a lot of times, you know, these disaffected voters, especially people who say they're independent, are actually less likely to show up and vote. And so, you know, that's a huge gap in points, but the group might not be big enough to really do that much and have that much of an effect. And I think the other sort of important question to ask is how sort of volatile these preferences are over time. So we know that for partisans, you know, your preference gets settled very early. If you're a Republican, you know already who you're voting for probably in November. If you're a Democrat, you already know who you're voting for. And so, you know, we're still months and months away from the election. So what's, you know, and this, it's a very unpredictable world right now.
Yes.
So I think how volatile these voters are, I think, you know, proceed with caution, you know, sort of looking at
Right. We have a vast amount of time before our general election. Evan, your view on this polling?
Well, I think Megan covered it pretty thoroughly there. You know, one of the ironies is this is sort of what happened with Hillary Clinton, where she was the devil everyone knew. Trump was the devil nobody knew. And so they went with that one. I had dissatisfaction.
These disaffected voters decided that way.
Right.
That was
yeah.
their thinking. Uh-huh.
And then it looks like it's flipped, at least for now. But like Megan said, all of this is highly volatile.
Mm-hmm. Evan, in closing here, let me have you talk a little bit about something you called to my attention, a new study that looked at, well, claims about voting by mail. Of course, the coronavirus pandemic threatens our general election, our primaries having to be refigured in order to accommodate. Well, we don't want to endanger people going to cast a ballot. And many people fear that the pandemic could deter many people from voting or expose them to infection if they do. So officials around the country calling for a nationwide expansion of voting by mail. What do you make of the arguments voiced by some party leaders in both parties that say that voting by mail would help their opponents? We've heard this from President Trump. He claimed that if the entire nation voted by mail, in his words, you'd never have a Republican elected in this country again. Evan, you've looked at this new study. What did it show?
Right. This is actually some really good new scholarship on this. And what it shows is that there's not a doesn't make much of a difference. Your turnout, your average turnout might go up a little, but it evens out. So it doesn't actually benefit one party or the other. The old belief was that if the more people that vote, the better it would be for the Democratic Party. But it looks like in the studies they've done, county by county, on these, that it's a wash.
Mm. And it would really depend on the race and so forth.
Right.
Megan, have you looked into this at all? Thoughts?
Yeah, this is some exciting new research out. I think the one sort of open question regarding this is, like, a lot of these studies are done in states that have not had violations, let's say, of the Voting Rights Act. And so I think sort of one concern people do have is, like, will this just inspire new and interesting ways of voter suppression if you're voting by mail? But I think, you know, I agree that the Republican opposition to this is driven by this fear. And the hope is that this new scholarship will perhaps ease those fears and push voting by mail forward, because it has a lot of benefits. It does increase turnout, and more participation in a democracy is usually a good thing.
Right, but perhaps I'm not thinking creatively enough, Megan, but I'm trying to think of, I'm sure there are, you're absolutely right, voting by mail offers people who want to suppress the vote more opportunities. Have you heard of any specific instances or the how of that?
No, not at all. I think, I don't want to give anyone ideas, Ben.
Evan, jump in there and don't give people any ideas.
Yeah, I'm trying not to give people any ideas, but the study does show one of the reasons why this becomes a wash is that for whatever reason, we don't know why yet, minority, black Hispanics tend to not mail these things back at the percentage that their Anglo counterparts do. So that's one of the reasons why this thing sort of evens out. So the study just, you know, says what it says. We'll have to figure out why that is.
Yeah. Okay. Very quickly before we go, I wanted to ask briefly, how are you two doing in terms of social distancing and teaching at major institutions of learning? How is it working, Megan, as you come to the end of this semester?
Today is our last day of class. It was an interesting experience. I took my class with social media. We did a lot of our discussion on Instagram. So that was really enjoyable for me. Cornell going forward has adopted a new plan where we've added blocks in the summer. And so we're hoping that next year, I foresee us probably being online at least for parts of the year. I'm glad we got a little practice now before we have to do it again.
Okay. Your view, Evan Renfro, in 30 seconds.
So we made the migration to online. It's quite a shock to the system. This summer, we'll be teaching online, and the hope is that we can get back to face to face in the fall. You know, because you lose so much, in my view.
Yep. Online. Yeah, right. We hope we can all get back to face to face. Evan Renfro, assistant professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Megan Goldberg, assistant professor of American politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Megan and Evan, you make a good team. We'll have to have you back together again sometime. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and tune in again tomorrow.